Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to the show. I'm Scott.
Hi, I'm Ben. Oh, man.
Rough one, huh?
Here we are again. Yeah, rough night. You know, I've got a second job now where people will call me. I'm on call as a cocktail trivia guy.
Really?
Yeah, so if somebody wants to sound educated or smart or something, I have to give them, you know, they call really quickly. It could be any time at night. Mm-hmm. And I have to give them a quick statistic about something.
Oh, sounds stressful.
It is, man. It pays pretty well. But you know, this kind of economy, everybody's got to have a hustle. There is one good thing though. I've learned quite a few, small facts that aren't big enough for a podcast, on their own, mm-hmm. but maybe altogether could make something really enjoyable.
I see. That's, we're pretty good at doing that, aren't we?
Yeah.
I mean, as far as like How Stuff Works goes, I mean, this is the place to go for stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, and, don't tell our boss, cause I think technically that's, a violation of my employment.
It might be. I'm kind of moonlighting.
Yeah, moonlighting. Today, ladies and gentlemen, is the day where Scott, super producer Noel Brown, and I get to do something we always enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. We get to just kind of piece some of that little stuff together that we didn't have quite enough room for in a podcast, or maybe some little bits of listener mail that come in that, you know, we want to talk about, but maybe isn't appropriate for a full length podcast.
Right.
You know, just there's all kinds of stuff. Just some catching up on some news. We're going to talk about an important rally that's coming, a road rally that's coming up. We're going to talk about, I've had some car trouble recently. We're going to talk about some nature. We're going to talk about bees.
Yeah.
Bees play into one of these stories heavily. And we'll talk about that, but it's an unusual tie-in. It does have a car, you know, relation in some way. I mean, we're gonna get it around to the cars, but yeah. There's all kinds of stuff here. So where do you want to begin? What do you want to start to talk about? Do a little listener mail, maybe?
Yeah, let's do. I like starting off listener mail. You got one?
Well, let's see. Let me shuffle some notes here. You caught me off guard. I suggested it, and then I didn't have it on top. Okay, so here's a good one. All right, this one comes from Facebook, and it was a guy named Adrian T. And Adrian wrote in, said, by the way, this is about the best Ford cars ever. And I think, that the car that came in number 13 on the list was the Ford Capri. And he says, by the way, I disagree with your thoughts on the Ford Capri. It was a wonderful car that was a massive hit in Europe throughout the 80s. You should do an episode on that car and explore its rich history. And you should also note that the later US only Fox body Mustang derivative and the two seat convertible off the Mazda 121 platform. So I guess there's a lot to cover there. And, you know, I mean, he's right. There was a huge fan following of this vehicle over in Europe.
Yeah.
Not quite as much here in the United States. It just wasn't as popular. But, I mean, that's probably why it was on this, this you know, best Fords of all time list.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that makes sense. And thank you for writing in, Adrian. We knew when we did that episode that we were going to get some feedback on that. You know, whenever it's somebody's favorite or whenever it's something bad. Because I can tell you this pretty honestly, guys, in my memory, almost every time we've done an episode on cars that, especially cars that weren't great, we have received some email about it. Even cars of the Iron Curtain.
Yeah, or cars that are, you know, the best of lists.
The best of lists,
because,
yeah.
Because if you're taking a list and you're saying, here's number one on this list, a lot of people say, how can you possibly make that number one on your list? Or what do you mean that's number 18 on that list?
Right.
There's no way. Yeah, exactly right. So there's always some contention once we read those. But it's kind of fun. I kind of like that. I like that people write in there. You know, it shows me that they're paying attention.
Yeah.
And I'm the same way. You know, if I disagree with the list, I'll say something. But that's the thing, is everybody's got their own opinion.
Yeah, and I welcome those opinions,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, and who knows? We'll probably end up doing a Ford Capri podcast at some point in the future. I don't know if we're going to do one right away, but I will put it on the list.
It's on our list, yes. Adrian. Here's one from Joseph H., who wrote to us on Facebook and has something for all the Rolling Coal fans out there.
Mm.
So Joseph sent us what may be a very important announcement for some of you guys. I'm not going to name names. But for coal rollers, watch out. Illinois General Assembly has a new bill in play that would result in a $5,000 fine.
Whoa.
For rolling coal.
That is a serious fine. Not messing around.
Now, you know, of course, the EPA already has laws that apply to messing with emissions, right? Emission controls. And they've had those for a while. But this bill wants to amend the Environmental Protection Act, stating that no person shall retrofit any diesel-powered vehicle with any device, smokestack, or other equipment that enhances the vehicle's capacity to emit soot, smoke, or other particulate emissions, and shall purposely release significant quantities of soot, smoke, or other particulate emissions into the air and onto roadways and other vehicles while operating the vehicle. Wow, that's a thrilling read.
Yeah.
But, man, $5,000.
$5,000 for rolling coal.
That's hefty.
Yeah, it really is. Man, it would make you think twice before flipping that switch to dump the fuel.
I mean, I feel like that's an excessive fine.
Yeah, we did that whole podcast on rolling coal, and it was pretty fascinating how, you know, the different levels that you could do that. I mean, you could spend just a couple $100 and make it do a sort of, you know, like a kind of a homemade job. And then you can go all the way up to, I think it was like $7,500 or something crazy like
that.
You could get into some really heavy modification to make that happen. But man, $5,000 fine. That's pretty excessive.
500
so
clams, man. 5,000 clams.
Watch out in Illinois. All right. Here's an email that comes from Patrick B. And he wrote in about vintage car features, but he had a note ahead of time here. He said that regarding spare tires. He says, I have an off-road Jeep and a full-size spare tire is required, as you can imagine, for different purposes, right? For different reasons, if you're going to be off-road. Now, on a passenger car, a spare tire I consider insurance. And I think that's a good way to look at it, a spare tire as insurance.
Yeah, that's a really good point, man.
And then he goes on to say, that said, listening to your recent podcast, if you research some of the newer Space Saver tires, so, you know, the most recent models that are out there, believe it or not, they have speeds that are allowed up to 70 miles per hour and ranges up to 250 miles or more. So remember we had talked about, you know, the speeds were limited to like, I think it was 35 miles per hour.
Right, yeah.
And 50 miles maximum. Now they're up to 70 miles per hour and ranges of, you know, above 250 miles. If, you know, not all cases, of course, you have to check, you know, your vehicle to be sure that you have one that is capable of that. But, I thought that was pretty interesting. And then, you know, getting on to the vintage car features that he mentions. He said you mentioned the pull knob vents on old cars. He said I had a couple of old 1970s vehicles, and I believe one of my 1980s Ford pickup trucks had the kind of kick panel vent that was down by the parking brake and also on the opposite passenger side that you could open this vent and this wonderful rush of air would come in from the inner fender well. And I remember these. It's almost like a pass through to the front wheel. It was probably really dangerous now that I think about it. I'm sure there was some type of you know, screen in place so that stuff didn't come in there, you know, whether it's animals or debris or whatever. But it was air that was directly from that inner fender well. And he says that, you know, the rush of air, you know, not only was it refreshing, of course, but it also helped dry out carpet, floor mats, and shoes if you were working outside in bad weather. So that was a good point, Patrick. I appreciate you writing in.
Yeah, we've got another Facebook message here that, well, actually, Scott, I'll read one of these. I'll read a couple, but I think we responded to one earlier. Our buddy Josh B., you remember him.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the people who wrote in to talk about the car stuff or the car talk episode.
Excuse me.
Yeah. And he said, thanks for doing the car talk episode. I was trying to think of a favorite car talk moment. And I think mine was the man that called in wanting to electrify the bodies of cars in his driveway to keep the goats off of them. Mostly so his girlfriend would start visiting again.
What a wild story.
Yeah.
That's funny.
I think it was true. Between interesting and funny stuff like that, the little ongoing things that would bring up, like the sleek black beauty, the life and death of the Dart, and stuff you guys mentioned, it was pretty often I would listen and laugh until I hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one person who wrote in for that one. Mark F. also wrote in, said, thanks for the recent podcast on Car Talk. I was an avid off-on fan for a decade. They had a way of hooking anyone who listened. I'll miss the show. Thought you guys did a good job of nodding your heads to some of the great car minds and honored them well. And I just wanted to say, Mark and Josh and everybody who wrote to us about that episode, thank you guys very much. We had one guy, we had somebody write to us, which I think is on Facebook. Yeah, Doc Gonzo wrote to us and said, thanks for putting me on to Car Talk, guys. I was starting to get to the end of car stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And he's got to be joking. There's no way that you haven't heard about Car Talk. Come on,
Well,
Doc.
You know what? I think he meant by that. I think he was saying, like, thanks for reminding me about it. Because, because you know, all these podcasts are now available online, the best of, and, you know, all these remixes of the shows. And I, too, am starting to listen to these more often now. Because after that show, it kind of sparked my excitement about it again. Mm-hmm. You know, I would catch it on the radio occasionally, not every week, because, you know, if I was in the car, happened to be in the car at that time when it was on. And now, you know, being able to access it anywhere, you know, at my desk or whatever while I'm doing other things, or just at home, you know, mowing the lawn or whatever. It's very, very handy. And I think that's what he meant by it, is that you kind of reminded me of that. And, oh, you know, there's a year's worth of listening there.
Oh, yeah.
As well, or
easily.
More. Probably more.
Again, we appreciate it. And that remains one of our favorite shows. What do you want to do? You want to do some more listener mail? You want to do some stuff Scott sees?
How about
facts?
This? Let's see.
I've got a weird one.
Okay.
I got just some stats. You want to hear some stats?
Let's hear some stats, and then I want to tell you about a road rally that's coming up.
Ah, yes. Good. Yes. That's a big one for us today. All right. So, the old eternal debate. Scott, Benjamin, ladies, gentlemen, listeners of Car Stuff. Well, I should say ladies, gentlemen, and the ill-behaved.
I like it.
So there is this continual debate, and it's something that's a weird situation you have encountered yourself, my friend. Should you drive on the right-hand or the left-hand side?
Okay.
What side should have traffic, right?
Yeah.
So if you're like us, you've wondered, because regardless of which one might for some reason be correct or incorrect or better, the one you grew up driving with is going to be the natural way for you.
Yeah.
But the statistics show us something different. 65% of the world's population, Scott, lives in countries with right-hand traffic.
65%.
Go us.
Really?
I'm totally kidding, UK and Australia, because they are amongst the 35% of countries with left-hand traffic. However, the world's total distance of roads, like if we measure by miles or kilometers for anyone outside of the US, 90% of that is traffic on the right.
Okay. All right. That's interesting.
Because just because of the infrastructure that those countries have, you know, the majority of Western Europe drives on the right.
Okay.
They've got a bunch of roads.
Huh.
The United States drives on the right. Canada, right. Mexico, we got a bunch of roads.
All right. I know what you're saying about, you know, you feel like whatever you grew up with is probably what you feel most strongly about. Like, of course you should drive on the left side. Of course you should drive on the right side. I get it. But that's interesting when you tell me that 65% of all traffic in the world is on the right-hand side. I would think that it would be
a little more even, maybe?
I was actually thinking it was going to be more the other way. I thought more of the world drove on the left than that. I didn't know that the number was 35%. I didn't know it was that low.
Now, it's weird because there is...
I guess we're saying the same thing, aren't we?
Yeah.
It's
strange.
Thing.
But here's the thing. Remember when we did that road signs episode and we found out that countries in the United Nations have been duking it out over... everything from road signs to
the color of lights used at traffic, on traffic signals, and and what type of message should you use, and what type of font should be on that sign, and what should the shape be, and
what should the illustration of a person be?
Yeah.
So there's currently there's a thing called the Geneva Convention on Road Traffic.
Oh boy.
Yeah, and it's been ratified by almost 100 countries. But this is a big decision, and it is yet to be resolved. So I'm personally not saying that one is better than the other, because I think about British traffic every time I'm sitting at a light waiting to make a left-hand turn.
Oh, yeah.
And I think, man, if I were just in another country right now.
Well, then you'd be on the wrong side of the road.
You know, Scott, okay, clearly I don't have a plan. This is just a thought.
You know what? That was maybe the most unusual thing. I know that I talked about this when I came back, because I was in Europe recently, and I was actually driving in Ireland. I didn't get to drive in the other places that I went, but in Ireland I was driving, and I was on the left side, and it was so unusual when you get to that, you know, first few intersections,
mm-hmm.
and having to deal with roundabouts, but in the opposite direction. And it's things like that were so mentally challenging, but only right before you got to it. And then once you're doing it, you kind of just follow the way everybody else is going, and it really becomes not an issue. It's not that difficult.
Right. Just an adjustment space.
Yeah. The stewing about it is worse than the doing, you know, because it's,
nice.
That's a term, right? Stewing is worse than doing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It's truly it because, you know, you think about it ahead of time and you kind of psych yourself out, like it's going to be difficult. But then when you get there, it's like, well, you just follow the traffic patterns and, you know, you get to those intersections, the rare intersections where there's no one around. And then it's a little bit confusing. You know, you might think, you know, you might start to go to the right side of the road there,
mm-hmm.
Or make the left-hand turn when you should, or I'm sorry, make the right-hand turn when you shouldn't be making the right-hand turn. Things like that. It's just the weird, you know, trying to transition from one way to the other way is the most difficult part.
So, That's a really good point. I'm going to transition to some more statistics, but I won't give all the context for that unless you want to stop me and tell them.
No,
tell
go, them. Go ahead.
These are just things I found that I thought were interesting.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. All right. There are more cars than people in Los Angeles. There are 1 billion cars on the road right now.
1 billion.
1 billion. The inventor of cruise control was blind. True story. We can talk a little bit more about him if you want. Car wrecks are the number one cause of death for Americans under 35.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm 33. I better play it safe.
Yeah, you've got a couple years.
I'm feeling like a cop, you know, like a couple days before retirement in an action movie, you know. Apparently, it is a crime to drive around in a dirty car in Russia, but they can't be enforcing that. You've seen the dash cams.
Oh, my gosh. There's far crazier things happening in Russia.
The first car accident, now this is debatable. The first car accident occurred in Ohio in 1891. I think they mean the first car collision into another car.
Could be.
Not the first time a car just hit a person or something stationary.
I would not think that. I would think that the first day that somebody was driving a car, like the first car, probably there was an accident. I mean, as far as them bumping a pole or a tree or something, mm-hmm. you know. But yeah, that must be a, like car to car collision, like
yeah.
two vehicle accident,
car on car crime.
Yeah. Yeah. Two vehicle accident.
75% of cars that Rolls Royce has ever produced are still on the road today.
I believe that.
And that's something we've talked about a little bit. I think
it's a great stat.
It is a great stat. This one is not so much. The, average U.S. driver spends about 38 hours, a year in traffic.
Mm.
Just in traffic.
I spend that much a month. just about. I really do. Not kidding.
So let's see. If I have one more stat, just for anyone planning a road trip, I do want you to know that if you left Earth in a car going 60 miles per hour somehow in space, you could get to the moon in a little less than 6 months.
Now, what kind of stat is that, Ben? If you're driving to the moon, driving to the moon. So if they build a bridge to the moon,
okay.
How long would it take? 6 months?
A little less than 6 months.
Oh, well, that's easy then. It's a year round trip.
So you could just take some time off,
a
sabbatical.
Wow.
You're right. You're right. We'll just have one more real stat then, since that was a little bit too. Sci-fi.
Okay.
About 165,000 cars are produced every single day.
No way.
That's everything.
165,000 cars every day around the world.
Mm-hmm.
All around the world.
And that number is probably going to go up.
That's amazing.
Because then, you know, we'll think about it. That's gonna go up because there are more foreign manufacturers that are creating smaller vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
With honestly less regulation, so it's easier to make one, but it's a tough thing to make a car.
Well, you know, all those times that I've been at like assembly factories, you know, the final assembly where you see the cars coming off the line. I mean, they really are just cranking them out. I mean, especially I can think of the minivans in particular. I was in the Windsor assembly plant a long time ago, like late 90s. And they were just one after the other, just fast assembly on those things. I mean, as far as, you know, being a popular model, of course they were popular for Chrysler. It was Chrysler product. I don't know if it was Dodge or Chrysler. I can't remember exactly which. I think it was Chrysler.
Mm-hmm.
But they were really just flying off the line. I couldn't believe how many of them they were producing. Just in the few minutes that I was at the last part of the line, or, you know, maybe an hour or whatever, I can't even tell you how many I saw come off the line.
Yeah, it's strange to think about that number. And you can, I want to be clear, this is a rough estimate. You can find other estimates that will be as much as, you know, 200,000 something every year, but, or every day, but I think they count that as every business day. So you have to watch out for the stats. There is a neat thing you can go to. I just want everybody to know about this, called worldometers.info on their car section. And they have this, let me show this to you.
Is this where you got the moon stat?
This is not where I got the moon stat,
I
but
see.
It has a running count of cars produced since the beginning.
Oh,
of,
I like those.
Sometimes
you see those on the highway or something, you know, with like the number of tires that Goodyear has produced this year. Or,
right.
You know, stuff like that. I mean, yeah. I love those counters that that continually count up.
Number of hamburgers served by McDonald's,
yeah,
or something.
The numbers always astound me.
I like them when there's something positive, but then sometimes they're like the national debt.
Well, yeah, that's true. That one goes up even way faster than that one.
It does.
And, you know, other, I think there's a population counter for here in Atlanta, but I believe, and I could be wrong, maybe they've updated it, but I think it ran out of positions.
Oh, really?
Because the population grew to the point where it was unable to keep counting like that. You know,
go I mean, us.
Yeah, I guess. That's part of the reason I'm spending more than 38 hours in my car every month. All right. So let's talk about something a little different.
Yeah.
Let's talk about something that we talk about every year. And I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this, but it is a great cause. And I want to mention again, because we have a dedicated listener. His name is Glenn Beck.
Right. And of course, we're talking about the famous Glenn Beck, who works with this charity every year.
Yeah. This is the Glenn Beck, the car stuff listener, Glenn Beck.
Yeah.
Not the radio guy.
Right. There is some other Glenn Beck, but I don't really remember him.
We do this gag every year.
Yeah. Yeah. Be careful with this bit. It's an antique.
Yeah. Don't go back. It falls a little flat every time you hear it. But, all right. So anyway, this is the Glenn Beck that we're talking about, and he participates in this rally every single year. And he's something he writes into us about and says, hey, it'd be great if you guys could kind of spread the word. And that's what we're doing. It's, we do this every year. He runs in a team called, Team Limer, and he drives a Mustang. And very cool looking Mustang, by the way. If you get a chance, go to rallynorthamerica.com and take a look in the gallery. And it's likely that you'll see a photo of him there. I quickly looked through it before we came in to do this podcast. And, there's a lot of pony cars that participate in this, but I'm sure that he's in there somewhere. We'll find him. I'll try to get a shot of him. The dates of the rally this year, it's called Rally North America. And this year's specific rally is called the CJ Pony Parts Smoky Mountain Rally 2015. And the dates are July 14th through July 16th. And I'll tell you where it goes to and from in just a minute, but it benefits a charity, and it's a different charity every time. And they do a couple of rallies every year. This one in particular benefits Hope for the Warriors. And registration, unfortunately, for this rally is already closed, but that's good news because that means all the spots are filled.
Yeah.
So this rally is full. You can still donate, of course, if you want to go to the site and check that out. But if you, in the fall, you know, there's another one coming up. So if you can't make it to this one, you know, you want to be involved, but you can't do it. There's another one coming up in the fall. It's called the Ohio Valley 700, fall of 2015. And the next one will benefit the Epilepsy Foundation of Western Ohio. And that's from October 9th through October 11th. The locations of that one, you know, where they're going to go is unknown. But the one that's happening right now is really close to us, Ben. It's one that, you know, there's a chance we might be able to go out and see. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
We're going to try to talk to our management and see if we can get out to maybe see this. But it's not a race, so there are definitely rules in place. But it's a road rally.
Right.
And day one starts in Knoxville, Tennessee at the World's Fair Park. But registration does open on August 1st for that second fall rally if you want to do that. Now, going back to the one that's going to happen right now, the one that's going to happen in the Smoky Mountains, you know, the one that's kind of close to us.
Yeah.
And by the way, we're going to try. We're going to ask management if we can somehow get out to this. I'm not going to guarantee or anything, but we're going to try to get out.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, we're going to try. So day one of this rally, it's again, July 14th. It starts in Knoxville, Tennessee, and it ends up in Henderson, North Carolina. Day two is from Henderson, North Carolina to Athens, Georgia. This includes, and this is why this rally is so cool. This usually includes some racing activities that go along with it. So, when they're in Athens, Georgia, they're going to go to the Atlanta Dragway and have drag races in the evening.
What? That's
yeah. So,
cool.
So after a day of rally road racing or rallying, I guess, You go to the Atlanta Dragway and do some drag racing against all the other competitors. And then the next day, you start out in downtown Athens, Georgia, and you drive to Savannah, Georgia, historic Savannah, which is a beautiful place. And they're going to go to the, I think it's called the Roebling Road Raceway. So it's a road course that they're going to do. And this is open racing with no limits, no limits in place. So you can just openly race with your, you know, fellow competitors. And as I said before, if you go to the gallery and you look at who's participating, it's cars with, you know, they're all decaled up. They look like race cars.
Right.
A lot of pony cars. So you're going to see, you know, lots of Camaros, Mustangs and Chargers and things like that, you know, Challengers, things like that.
Yeah.
A lot of those types of cars are going to be there. So it's always a fun event. I mean, I love watching it. I love hearing about it from Glenn. So hopefully they'll get some, you know, some big donations. I mean, it costs $400 to enter this plus a $100 donation for the charity. But if you're not able to participate right now, like I said, you can still donate if you want to, because it's a good cause. The Hope for the Warriors for the first one, and the second one will be again for the Epilepsy Foundation of Western Ohio. So we always mention this stuff, and it's a great cause. They sometimes benefit children's charities and things like that. It's just a great group of people, and check it out if you'd like to.
Yeah, we can't say enough good things about the rally. Mm-hmm. So yeah, please do let us know. And speaking of high-performance vehicles, Scott, did you know that demand has already driven Dodge to build more Hellcats?
Really?
Yeah.
That's good news.
That's
really good news.
They just recently managed to figure out how to add 1,000 cars to the build schedule. So there are going to be 1,000 more Hellcats. I'm assuming that a lot of our listeners have already heard stuff like this. We haven't done a podcast on the Hellcat yet, but we have certainly talked about it, and we even saw one, kind of. We didn't get to...
Well, sort of. It was in the rain, and it wasn't running.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so, but we did see one, and it's pretty unusual to be able to see one in person. I know that I think each dealer received one, maybe.
Right.
It was kind
of like
a halo car to bring people in.
Uh-huh.
But fascinating car. I would love to see one in action. We just haven't seen it yet, and We talked to somebody recently that was looking for a manual transmission version of the Hellcat.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Dennis McCarthy.
Uh-huh.
Remember that?
Yeah, that's right. Dennis McCarthy, whom we spoke with, or you spoke with specifically, regarding the Fast and Furious 7.
Yeah, yeah. It's called, I think it's just Furious 7. Mm-hmm. And because they all have a little variation on the name, but this one's Furious 7. And look back in our podcast history if you didn't catch that one.
Yeah,
but,
I like to say the whole thing.
He was a neat guy. He was a fun guy to talk to with an interesting job.
Yeah.
Really
gosh, fascinating. Yeah. Just a quick thing about the Hellcat here. If you don't know, it has a 707 horsepower V8 engine, which makes it the most powerful production engine ever made by an American brand.
Mm-hmm.
A production car engine, at least.
Yeah, yeah. Not too bad for a sedan, I guess. A four-door sedan with 700 plus horsepower.
I mean, just, you know, sometimes you got to go.
Yeah, usually use that term in a different way when you're on a road trip or something. All right, so let's see. I've got a few different things here. I mean, man, I do want to get to the Red Bees. I'd like to tell that story, but maybe before that, let me just maybe briefly mention some of my my own personal car woes that I've been having. I hinted at this in the last Nuts and Bolts.
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
and I'll just quickly go through this. I mean, there's trust me, there's a lot of material here. There's a lot of little nuances mm-hmm. in this story that I will not go into, but this is just kind of what's been going on since about mid-February for me with my own car. First of all right, Valentine's Day, my wife and I are out. We went to a movie, mm-hmm. and we were headed to a restaurant, and it's in the mall area. You know, they're outside the mall, like, you know, on the property, though. And I'm driving her car, her Honda Element. It's a 2006 Honda Element. And as we were driving around the mall, and you can picture this, there's a drive that goes all the way around the mall, and it's a couple of lanes wide on each side. Well, I'm in the, I guess I'm on the inner lane, and there's an outer lane also, and that's one that's exiting the mall property. So there's a backup of traffic to a stop sign, and my lane is clear, so I'm driving through. And a taxi cab was coming the other direction, mm-hmm. and was cutting through the stopped line of traffic, and the person who was someone waved them through from the stop line of traffic, and the cab just drove right into the front end of our car as we're in the inner lane, you know, not at speed, but, you know, going slow, like maybe 10 to 15 miles an hour. And the crazy thing is that I don't think he ever looked. So, you know, the person waved him through, and he didn't even look, you know, at the traffic that was approaching, just went, he was trying to enter the mall parking lot area. And we contacted, and I thought, oh my God, you know, so we both kind of abruptly came to a stop, you know, with the front ends together, like his side and my front, his passenger side and my front end. And then he continued to drag his taxi cab along the front of our car to pull into the parking lot.
You said it was kind of slowly, right?
Slowly drug his car across the front end of ours, like trying to nearly remove the bumper, the front bumper. It was so frustrating because it didn't have to be that bad. I mean, it was already bad. You know, there was a lot of damage already, but it got worse. I mean, in the seconds that followed, it was the strangest thing. So that happens. Now you can imagine that wasn't a very happy Valentine's Day for anybody.
No,
it was a bit awkward. So, you know, I destroyed my wife's car, and you know, then there's that whole rental car cycle that goes along
that
with this,
and
contacting the paint shop and the insurance company, mm-hmm. and all that. So that's all happening, right? Then at the end of, I think it was the end of that month, beginning of March,
right?
I was driving to Indiana. I was going to spend my grandfather's birthday together with him. Mm-hmm. He is 93 this year, and I was having a birthday as well. That's, you know, 2 days away from each other.
Yeah.
So we were celebrating together like we've done, you know, for a long, long time, many, many years. And it's like a 1,300-mile round trip. So I drive up there. It's to northern Indiana, and I come back home in my Honda Civic. Is that 2005 Civic Si that I had?
Uh-huh.
The hatchback. Well, about 2 days after I got back from the trip, or a day after I got back, I pulled into a gas station. I went to start the car, and it wouldn't start. And it would run like maybe 3 seconds and then die, and run 3 seconds and die. And I was thinking it was a fuel problem, so it wasn't a big deal.
Right.
So I called the service. It's like $20 to get hauled to the nearest Pep Boys, and I did that. I thought that was a great deal instead of $80 or whatever. So I did that, and I'm waiting around for it thinking they're going to tell me it's, you know, a $30 part or $50 part or whatever. Well, they walk me in the back like a couple of surgeons that have some bad news to deliver.
Oh gosh, to got to tell the family. That's
and,
the worst part.
And they show me that there's zero compression in any cylinder of my car. All four cylinders have zero compression.
Zero.
Zero. None. So the engine has just given up. I mean, it's they looked inside the oil fill area. And I could see the camshaft, or one of the camshafts, that had lots of wear on it from where there had been metal inside. You know, it had been in there for who knows how long.
Mm-hmm.
It had just destroyed the cam, and it was, you know, not allowing them to, you know, the valves to lift up at the right time, et cetera. You know what's going on there.
Right, yeah.
So it was more expensive to open that engine up and figure out what was wrong with it than it was to replace it. And the cost to replace it was more than the car was worth.
Yeah, because what year was it again?
It was a 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Honda Civic Si, it was the hatchback version, and the engine was very expensive, whether you went used or rebuilt.
Right.
Used was cheaper, obviously, but still, even then, it was more than the car cost. So I had to do this whole cost analysis on paper and figured out that it just wasn't worth it to put an engine in it. So I no longer have that Honda that I loved.
Which is a shame.
It is a shame. And that car was so clean. And suddenly, you know, I'm driving to work, and the next thing you know, I have no car.
Mm-mm.
And I've got really nothing to sell because it's essentially scrap.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is.
That's unless, all you can sell it for.
Unless you can find somebody that's willing to put that much money into it. And I was calling around. I literally was calling around to scrap yards, like asking them how much they'll give me. And they're pricing it by the pound, Ben.
Ah.
And that car was so clean. I know it was a 2005, but
yeah.
My neighbor even said that thing looked brand new. I don't know. You know,
you took really good care of that.
I really did. Yeah. And I was up on all the maintenance and everything. The source of the metal is still unknown. I'll never, ever know what happened there. I don't know if, you know, the timing chain skipped a gear or what. I don't know how that would be possible if it was loose, but I don't think that happened. It was just the most bizarre situation. I mean, and the only sign I got of that was going to happen,
yeah.
And I didn't even know this was a sign. On that trip, when I was about 20 or 30 miles from home, I had stopped for fuel, and I got back in the car, and when I started it up, it sounded like I had a pinhole in the exhaust somewhere.
Hmm.
I mean, it sounded like a really, because it sounded a little bit meaner. It sounded like a little more throaty, a little more like it was growling.
Yeah.
And that was the only indication that something mechanical was going wrong, but I thought it was something outside, something physical to the exhaust, that maybe I had hit something on the road or something that, you know, had punctured a hole or just had worn out, because
mm-hmm.
it had 171,000 miles on it, I think, at that point.
Uh-huh.
And after this long, long trip, it had been performing flawlessly. It was fine. No problems at all. And then that sound, and then, you know, 2 days later, it's totally dead. It was bizarre. It was a weird situation. So I mean, I know there's a ton of other stuff we could talk about with
that. Sure.
But now I'm stuck with a car that is scrap.
Yeah.
No down payment for a new car. I can't afford to fix that car.
Right.
Because it just doesn't make good, you know, financial sense. It doesn't make good business sense.
Yeah, I'd have to rent the car.
Yeah.
But there's light at the end of the tunnel, right?
There is, yeah. I had a rental car for about 2 weeks, you know, while I was trying to figure things out. I had to do that as kind of a stopgap procedure. And I got I rented a Mini Cooper, which was very nice. And when I got in that one, I realized immediately, yeah, my other car was pretty old and whipped. It was pretty beat up. You know, mechanical wise, I guess as far as like, you know, the way it felt, it was definitely a lot crisper, a lot cleaner handling.
Oh, yeah.
Well, of course it's going to be though. You know, it's a 2015 Mini Cooper.
Yeah.
But I did buy a new car and recently, and it's I bought a 2012 Volkswagen CC Sport. And I love this car. It's a great car. I've only had it, a few days now.
Uh-huh.
And I've put probably 300 miles on it already. I bought it in Macon, Georgia and got to drive it back, you know, one on the weekend. That was an interesting trip all on its own. But, man, there's so much to talk about. But anyways, that's my new ride. And that's what's been happening in the last, like, let's say month and a half.
Congratulations.
It's been crazy. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. But it's been insane with the cars in my house recently.
It was a hard road to get there.
Yeah. And I know. Sorry. I apologize for going on and on about it. But, man, that's a lot happening.
It is because I didn't want to say it. But after the Valentine's Day parking lot massacre, which is how I think of that story in my head, after the Valentine's Day parking lot massacre, there was a time where I can't remember if you and I were supposed to meet up to work on something for the show or what it was, but it was one day where you just weren't in the office.
Yeah. That was probably the day.
And,
that was back on March 10th.
I think I don't think I emailed you because I figured, well, he's going to go in, but there was a moment where my spider sense twinged, my shining went off just a little. And I thought, should I text this guy? Should I like, you know, call him or something?
Yeah.
I'm glad it worked out. And, you know, it was a tough road, but you ended up with a new car.
I did. And, you know, that kind of thing is rough to go through. I mean, especially when you're getting rid of an old friend like that. Cause I mean, it's hard. I mean, I truly love that car and I would be driving it today if it made financial sense to drive it. And it, in a way it did, but I would have to keep that car for so long and it needed other things and it just didn't balance out the right way. And, I think I made the smart decision, but I'm back having a car payment again, and that's kind of a drag. But man, I really do love the new car too. It's nice.
Yeah.
It's nice. It's a nice switch. So you got to do that occasionally. And who knows, Ben? I mean, I said never about that one too, but who knows? Monte Carlo maybe next, right?
Yeah. Well, it could happen. I am offended that you say so, but
I understand.
But yeah, you're not wrong. It's the As I've said before on this show, listeners, you know this, it's not the best car, but it's not the fastest, it's not the smartest, but it's my car.
It's your car and you love it.
I love not having a car payment, man.
And it's comfortable.
Oh yeah,
it really
is comfortable. But you know, it's got some issues. It's a 04, about 173,000 on it.
Yeah.
So, eventually, There will have to be a reckoning.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I mean, you're in kind of the same spot I was in. I mean, as far as like, you know, you grow attached to these cars.
Oh, yeah.
You really do.
Yeah.
And I mean, you and I both keep cars for a long time. So when I, you know, was looking for something new, it was very puzzling. Like, what am I going to be happy with for 8 years? What am I going to be happy with for 10 years?
Yeah.
That's really a tough decision to make when you weren't even expecting to make it. And suddenly one afternoon you have to decide what you're going to do.
Oh, yeah, that's just terrible.
It's a bad spot. If you can plan for it, that's another thing.
And listeners, if you you probably have a story like this. This has happened to most families. At some point, there's going to be something that is unforeseen, no matter how well you care for your vehicle. It could be another driver. It could be an internal problem, but it could end up with your car going kaput.
Yeah, you could.
If I got a different car now, immediately. I've been considering a couple, and one of them I'm thinking about is a foreign car, Scott.
Really?
Yeah.
I would not have expected that from you.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't have expected myself either. But
would it be more expensive than the one you're driving now, or is it less expensive?
It's a little more expensive.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What have you got in mind?
Well, remember when we did that previous episode for Fast and Furious 7, or excuse me, Furious 7, and
It's okay. You can say the full thing. Fast and Furious 7.
Is it okay?
It's not the title, but you can say it.
I like the way it rolls off the tongue. So there's something that our buddy Dennis mentioned there, which was the Lycan Hypersport.
Oh, that's what you're considering.
Yeah, like a daily driver kind of
really
easy going.
Yeah,
but
sure.
It has some speed.
Yeah, that seems totally plausible.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are totally kidding. This car is $3.4 million.
Yeah, it's a very, very expensive car. And only 7 of them were made.
Right, yeah. It is the third most expensive car to ever be made, in fact. And there are some reasons why, right? It's pretty luxurious.
Oh, it is, yeah. It's all the – well, of course, you know, it's got a Porsche engine, right?
Right.
And it says like a turbo V6 or – no.
It's a flat six.
A flat six, that's yeah. Right. Turbo flat six. And so it's a Porsche engine. It's a high performance supercar.
Yeah.
But really, the devil's in the details on this one, because that's not where all the cost comes in.
No, a lot of the cost comes in precious stones.
Precious stones that you add to your supercar, exclusive supercar. So what are some of the available precious stones? And locations.
You can get in the headlights. Now, the front lights themselves are actually titanium LED blades, right? With 420 diamonds on them.
15 carats of diamonds in the headlamps.
Yes. Yes, sir. And you can choose which rubies or diamonds you want embedded in the headlights. You can also choose between a selection of rubies, diamonds, sapphires, or yellow diamonds to be integrated into the vehicle somehow at your wherewithal. To me, I'm just going to say, to me, that is overdoing it.
Ah, yes. I do not think that there's anybody listening that thinks that it's not over the top to choose the precious stones that you're going to embed in your headlamps in your vehicle.
Oh, there's one person, surely. On the show, there's one person.
Listening to car stuff? I don't know.
There's one person who says, well, if I'm paying $3.5 million, I want to be able to do stuff like
that. Okay, well, if you're paying that price, I guess so. Now, this is a car that's made in Lebanon. So this is this is the first Middle East supercar that's been produced there. And again, it's very, very exclusive. 7 built, all in 2013, I believe.
Yeah, and I think 3 are sold.
Three are sold. You know what? It's hard to believe that they're not all sold out. When you hear things like, you know, the LaFerrari and some of the McLaren P1s and all those
right.
sell out production before it even starts, but that $3.5 million, that must be the point where people say, maybe this one's not for me. I'm going to drop it down a level and go with the most exclusive Ferrari.
You're right. Yeah. Yeah. To slum it a bit. But the weird thing is though, too, for early adopters, that this, the company making this is a company named W Motors, and this is also their first car.
Yeah. First car.
It's
and
the first car.
What a bold statement, huh? I mean,
yeah.
I think they have headquarters in Italy, or they have a design house in Italy.
Yeah, they have a design house in Italy.
And, so a Lebanese sports car. I mean, that's just a strange thought or strange way to think of this whole thing. It's a Lebanese sports car.
Yeah.
It's just somewhere that doesn't typically come up with something like that. But, maybe we'll see more from that region. Who knows?
Yeah, maybe we will. For my part, I'm all about, more global car companies.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that kind of competition is ultimately better for the consumer.
There's some big oil money in that region.
There really is.
I mean, there's certainly no shortage of people that can afford $3.5 million for that kind of car.
Yeah, it's not a secret. I think that the market exists. I just don't know. You know, how do you persuade people? This is something for a different podcast, but how do you persuade people to take a chance on the car that you have built, this brand new name, when they are partially buying a brand name when they pay that much for a vehicle?
That's true.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But best of luck to W. I'd love to hear what turns out. I might need them to drop the price on the Lycan a little bit, so I'm going to keep the Monte Carlo going for now.
That's probably a good thought.
Well, you know, I want to be reasonable.
Hang on to it for another year or so. see where things are, where the market is.
Feel it out.
Yeah, I understand. Does it come in yellow? Because, you know, I was thinking that the Rainbow Sheik might like to pick one of these up.
Yes, the Rainbow Sheik. I wonder how he's doing.
Yeah, I don't know.
He never wrote to us.
No, he didn't. I don't think he's a listener.
What do you have next?
All right, Ben. So here's an interesting story, and I'll try to keep it all straight, and I'll keep it concise, because there's an intriguing tale that's happening, or that happened, I guess, in Brooklyn recently.
Oh, yeah. I love this one.
Yeah, and it has to do with red bees and a car collection, mm-hmm. a Cherry King, uh-huh. A nondescript factory, over-the-top security. It just has a real true crime feel to it, and I really like this story. And and it didn't quite turn out to be the car story that I thought it was going to be, but I was excited about it initially, thinking that, well, this could really turn into something. But it turns out it was just kind of a little less than I thought it was going to be. But it's a great story.
What's the word?
So here's what happened. In late February, one of our listeners, his name is Rudy Smith, and mm-hmm. I know I've mentioned Rudy many, many times here on this podcast. He sends us all kinds of great material.
Yeah, we're big Rudy fans.
We definitely are. He sent me a link to a story about a maraschino Cherry King that was caught with an alleged underground marijuana operation and a luxury and sports car collection that they had not known about, that committed suicide as they were investigating his factory. And how could you not be intrigued by this layout?
Right.
System,
yeah.
Right. So, but there's more to it than just that. The undoing of this guy, the downfall of this guy began back in 2010 with something that they call the Red Bees of Red Hook. And I mean, it's a fascinating way that this all ties together. And I'll try to walk you through this.
All right.
And tell you. But again, my initial interest in this was that they started pulling cars out of this factory that no one really knew were there. And I thought it was going to become some big collection, you know, like some massive exotic collection or something like that. And it turns out he did have some pretty amazing cars in there. I think he had a Rolls Royce. He had, I think, a Harley Davidson motorcycle, a Porsche. You know, there was a couple of things like that in there. But it didn't really amount to a whole lot. It wasn't a huge collection like I thought it was going to be. So, again, back in 2010, this guy's name is Mondella. His name is the Cherry King. His name is Arthur Mondella. And there's no way that he knew back in 2010 what was going on here, but this would be his undoing in 2015 eventually, but it would be, because back in 2010 this company that he owns, this is the Maraschino Cherries company that he owns, and it's a very profitable business. I guess it supplies to a lot of big name operations, you know, big name stores. It's called Dell's Maraschino Cherries Factory, and it's in Red Hook, which is a part of Brooklyn. The bees in that area, you know, there are beekeepers in that area as well. And the bees were coming back to this this beekeeping facility red. They were turning red.
Huh.
And they have apparently bees have I guess they have like a translucent stomach. And instead of carrying, pollen and, you know, the ingredients to make honey, I guess. I don't know the whole process here. I'm going to sound a little bit ignorant on that. But mm-hmm. The bees were getting into the red dye that was used in the cherry factory. You know, you could picture the red dye from a maraschino cherry.
Right, yeah.
So those are artificially dyed with red dye number 40. And so the beekeepers are getting mad that their bees are coming back with, you know, this gunk in their stomachs instead of, you know, what they need to in order to make good honey. So the beekeepers are mad. And at the same time, Arthur Mondella is getting mad because he's the CEO of this cherry company.
Yeah.
And he's angry that, you know, the bees are getting into his factory. So this is all going down in 2010. And they eventually discover, I think, that, and I'm going to wing this because I read it somewhere, but
right.
They eventually discovered that the bees were getting into the vats of cherries somewhere between when they were loaded and unloaded. And they needed to find a new way to enclose those bins.
Right.
To be able to keep them out. And that was the solution. So that worked for a while, you know, back in 2010. Well, in 2015, the red bees started showing up again.
The Red Bees of Red Hook.
The Red Bees of Red Hook showed up again. And you can look up Red Bees of Red Hook and read some of this.
Right. And so this is something with which the local police force is familiar. So this story is pretty recent, because in February of 2015, on a Tuesday morning around 8 a.m., NYPD stops by.
Yeah, they stop by, and, you know, they're going on a hunch. You know, they had because this is something that they had been watching. They had been watching for him, thinking that he was dumping the waste material from the factory into, the nearby river or something like that. You know, there was some place that, you know, the bees were getting into this outside the factory, that he was up to some no good that way.
Yeah.
Well, then when they're watching, like they're watching for this dumping activity, they start realizing like, okay, this guy's acting a little weird. He's driving around the block 5 times after work to look for surveillance. He's got over the top security here. Like, I mean, this is a cherry factory. It looks like just just any old warehouse in Brooklyn.
Right.
It's, you know, brick wall. It's got graffiti all over it. It's way over the top security. He's got, you know, like razor wire around it, security cameras everywhere. They're thinking, well, this is unusual. This is really strange. And not only that, and I don't even know if they knew this at the time, but they had tips from somebody, and they didn't say who this was, an informant, that said there is a huge underground pot operation going on in there. He's growing marijuana inside that factory, and I don't know if they ever investigated. I don't think they ever had grounds to really investigate it prior to this. So,
right.
So that's all kind of a like on the back part of their memory here as they're investigating him or watching him to see where he's dumping this red dye number 40.
And it's all right. It's all floating around. And when do these things start to converge?
Yeah.
So when they come by and they bust Arthur Mondelli, he's about 57 years old, with a warrant for environmental violations.
I think it was something environmental. But anyway, so they're in there searching around, and they've got, you know, this warrant to come in and look at the factory,
and they're there for like 5 hours.
Yeah, and they go into a of course they search the whole factory, don't really find a whole lot. It all looks pretty normal. They've even done aerial surveillance of the place because they think like, okay, well, this may be a chance to check out that that supposed marijuana situation
that's going
on there. And someone said that there's even a basement there, but the plans for the building said there was never a basement there originally. So that's something that would be new. This was dug after the fact, after the building was put up, without any kind of city permits or anything.
It's clandestine.
Yeah. So they're saying that, right? And they said, well, we don't really even see evidence of a basement here. There's nothing. It's a clean factory. It's just, you know, they're just producing cherries. That's it. And they've even done like helicopter surveillance with infrared cameras to see if there's like, you know, the signature glow of a grow house. And there was none of that because, of course, it was shielded by, you know, the floor of the building, the heavy concrete floor of the building.
Right. Yeah.
So they're in there and they do, you know, sense a faint smell of marijuana in the building, which was a giveaway, of course. And, they're in his office and they find this fake wall with some shelves that are attached to it by magnets. And right in this area is where they smelled the marijuana. So,
right.
So they knew to dig further right there. And as they pulled the shelf away, it reveals a stairway down to, lo and behold, a marijuana grow house, which is, I think they said it was like, he had 80 pounds or 90 pounds, but they think that was right after he had just harvested and sold it, you know, so that this is what's left over.
So at the same time the investigators are discovering this, or maybe slightly before, Mondella calls over his sister, Joanne, who's working at the location, and he asks her to take care of his kids. He goes to a restroom after that. He locks the door, and he shoots himself with a .357 Magnum.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Dramatic end. So the police are on site. They just discovered this illicit, growing operation in a basement that shouldn't even be there, you know, hidden by secret shelves that are held in place by magnets, and the investigators are talking to him. He excuses himself. He kills himself in the bathroom. This reminded me so much, Ben. We talked about this. This reminded me so much of that scene in Breaking Bad when the head of, was it Madrigal? I think Foundation or
which was
Madrigal
a chemical
company.
Supply company in Europe.
Yeah. And remember that? He went into the bathroom and he hooked the defibrillator up to himself and killed himself when he knew the authorities were coming.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what this guy did. And they said, you know, afterwards, that's when they discovered, like, okay, I think they maybe had discovered the cars already at this point. But afterwards, they said, you know, it's a big deal, but it's not a big enough deal that warranted this type of response from him. I mean, it wouldn't have been a huge, huge issue. I understand that, you know, he had done some wrong things and, you know, it probably would have been the end of his company. However, that's a dramatic response to something like this. And it was just an intriguing enough headline that it made me dig in further, and the whole Red Bee tie-in and all that. I mean, it was just fascinating. And again, I thought that, when the high-end vehicles started coming out of the building, I thought, oh my gosh, here we go. We're going to find, you know, 100 cars that are museum quality or luxury sports cars or whatever. I mean, I was really anticipating something big out of that, but it never ended up more than just, you know, 3 or 4, pretty interesting vehicles, I guess.
Yeah. And the strange thing, though, is that you wonder what else could have happened that would have, you know, prompted this guy to take his own life. I guess there's the concern about the reputation, of course.
Yeah. It was a family business from what, 1948, I believe, that his grandfather started.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was profitable too. I mean, so it's not like he really needed to do this as, you know, like a side business to make extra money. I mean, that money that he made from the marijuana business, I guess, I mean, just an example. I mean, you know, the 80 or 90 pounds of weed that was there, they found $200,000 in cash on hand that was stashed in suitcases. So, you know, he had a lot of money on hand. I know that was the illicit money that we're talking about, but $20 million in revenue for his business, he's a success. I mean, he doesn't need to do this side, you know, this dangerous, you know, illegal activity in order to make money on the side. He didn't have to do that, but he did. And I guess it was probably the shame that brought him to that. But I love the whole true crime aspect of this thing. And again, I was really hoping that he was going to have some crazy, you know, hidden secret stash of cars like we sometimes hear about.
I mean, there's a story everywhere. It may well be that there's more to this story than we realize.
Yeah.
It sounds like there is.
Well, I'm kind of wondering if what are we going to hear about? Like, what did they discover at his house? Or, you know, maybe he's got
a vacation home.
Maybe he's got another place somewhere else that he keeps, you know, his prize vehicles at. I don't know.
A cabin in New Hampshire.
Yeah, man.
Right.
Maybe.
Unfortunately, we have to go, but I think that is a great point to end this on, because what a story, man.
It is. And, you know, I'm probably not doing it justice. If you look it up, if you hadn't heard about this Maraschino Cherry King and the suicide that happened and, you know, the car collection and all that, it's a fascinating story. And again, look up, you know, for further information, go back to a story called The Red Bees of Red Hook.
Yeah.
And that will kind of, you know, tie the two together. And it's fascinating.
So thank you to Adrian, Joseph, Patrick, Josh, Mark, Glenn, and of course, Rudy, as well as everyone else who has written to us, tweeted, or just listened to our crazy little show here. We are headed now. Oh, but we do have something good. Okay, if you got excited about the idea of secret car collections, then, oh, brother, have we got news for you, because there are a bunch, and so many that we did a podcast on it earlier. Where can I find that, you might be wondering? Well, we have the answer for you. It is carstuffshow.com, where you can check out not only that, but every podcast we've ever done, along with some blogs and videos. If you have an idea or you would like to write to us directly, we'd love to hear from you. Our best suggestions come from the listeners, so send us an email. We are
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.